it really runs cookhouses anymore because the shows has found out it's got very expensive with them. Yeah. So it's really cheaper to give the people their money and do what they want to with their own food. You know what I mean? So
when you were to get back just a minute, you were talking about your Bird Act. Mm-hmm. I was wondering, do you happen to know how Bird Act started in show business?
Well, I don't know. There were years ago Bird Acts was around because I talked to a lady that her husband and them owned a show like in the 1940s. Her name Terrell Jacobs. They had and she told me she worked birds like back in the 1930s on some of the large corporation shows. They had macaws and things. But see, I would say in 1934, you see, the United States passed a law against all importation of citizen birds, which is all parrot-type birds because of psittacosis. And some sailors was bringing birds into the country, and they had psittacosis, which is like a flu-type virus or a pneumonia-type virus, which affects people. And so they passed a law against all birds. So from 34 on, parrots was really very scarce in this country. The only people that was allowed to bring them in was qualified zoos, or they were smuggled in. So this went on until about 1964 or 65, they finally, the U.S. Department of Health and Education and Welfare, all that departments, decided that rather than let people smuggle things in, they should do it and protect the public, you know, because if people want something, it's like prohibition, you know, they're going to get it one way or the other. So they might as well make it legal and do it proper. So then they finally set up quarantine, which they went through several different things. They started quarantining them outside the country and shipping them in. Well, they've ended up now, they are quarantined in the country after they arrived here in a government-approved station and by a government veterinarian as handles it. It's increased the price of birds, but it also has allowed more people to own birds, parrot-type birds, than ever before. And then with the cockatoo on Beretta show has made cockatoos extremely popular. In fact, it's made a lot of black market dealing in them, and there's been a lot of thefts in them. Cypress Gardens lost their show about 2 months ago. Their show was stolen, $25,000 worth of birds. And maybe you read in the paper last week, there was 6 parrots stolen from the Metro Zoo in Miami. And the one that was on TV, the birds that sing, and, you know, the African greys and the green apes, and they valued them at $10,000 apiece. They were from the man that trained the birds for the movie, Ray Berwick, in California Universal Studios. And he trained the movies. He's the one that trained the cockatoo on Beretta. And he trained the birds for San Diego Zoo. And he also trained them for Metro Zoo in Miami. And he had the show lease down, and he lost 6 of the birds just a week or so ago. Mm. So somebody wanted them awful bad to rake in and steal them.
Well, when you do become a bird or an animal trainer, though, do you try to find an older trainer to kind of apprentice with first?
Or? Well, that used to be that way, right. Just like we talked about this elephant man is a very well-respected elephant breaker from years ago, and you try to, but a lot of the people guard their secrets very closely, and it's very hard to break into it, you know, into the business, unless they really take a liking to you. And I found that to be true there. It's a very closely guarded thing sometimes for people to really help you do anything, you know. I don't whether they're envious of you or jealous of you or they're going to take their job or whatever, but it's very hard unless you get with a person that wants to retire, and then they'll teach you their routine or their act or whatever their job is, you know, that they want somebody to replace them as. But I learned my birds by myself. I just used, you know, you use discipline. Like you train any child or any, like a dog or anything. You got to use discipline with them and also affection. And so there's a few things that actually when you train birds, there's a little secret to it. You kind of train backwards from what you think you really would. If you want a bird to do something, you start them out kind of backwards. And then once they learn that, then you revert back. Like say if they wanted to pull a can up with a peanut in, you first let them eat out of the can with the peanut. You don't try to make them pull the chain with the can the whole thing up. You let them eat out of the can with the peanut. Let them know there's peanuts in the can, and peanuts is their special treat. Then you put the can away from them where they have to go to the can. Then you hang the can down on a chain and put them on the perch. And then the bird finally looks down, and then he thinks, well, how am I going to get that peanut out? So then he starts pulling the chain up with his beak and his feet to get the peanut out. So you see, you don't, like a lot of people think, you train, put the can on the chain right away. You don't. You start just kind of backwards. And you do that with a lot of things, a lot of their training. Riding the bicycle, you do a lot of things that way. You teach them kind of, you don't try to throw them into the whole thing at one time. It's like talking. When you teach a bird how to talk, you show them a peanut, you give them a peanut. Then you say hello to them, and you hold the peanut back. And when they go to start to talk, you give them the peanut. But then you keep holding the peanut back more and more until you get it perfected to what you want. And then when you get it perfected to what you want, then you reward them every time. And that comes pretty well, 100% then, you know, after a while, because they know they're going to get the peanut. They know they're not going to get it until they say, hello, folks, perfect, you know. Because I got one bird that kind of mumbles sometimes when he's not too hungry, he kind of mumbles, hello, folks, you know, something like that. But then if you say, keep holding the peanut, then finally he straightens his voice up and talks quite well. It's kind of funny. When I take care of my birds in the morning over there, I've got like four or five birds that I have broke that way, you know, to talk. Some of my show birds are retired at home and they're raising babies now. And I walk through and they see me coming in the morning. They're all yelling, hello, folks. They're all wanting their peanuts, you know, because I don't feed them peanut with their regular food. I use that for their treats.
So. For aerial acts, you said when you were growing up, you learned set up a little trapeze thing in the backyard. When you finally joined the circus that one summer, would you just start watching the other acts?
Yeah, I watched them, and very few of them like really helped me. Like this lady I told you about, her husband owned the show, and she helped me. She came in a couple times, three, four times, and helped me and told me things I were doing wrong. And once in a while, when people get to know that you're really sincere in it, some people will help you. They'll tell you you're holding your hand wrong, you should point your toes, you should, you know, keep your knees together and, you know, and smile at the audience and different things like that. You know, they'll really help you a lot. And when I got hurt with the accident and all I had left was my birds, and that's when I got into theatrical trimming, selling them a little bit, because I was laid up in the hospital for a long time, and I started selling theatrical stuff just to keep me, so I could visit shows and see people I knew, you know, because I wasn't able to walk yet. I was on crutches and leg braces. And then I got my bird act together. I went out and I worked as a pirate. So I had a good friend who's on Disney World on Ice now. He's on the ice show with the dog act. He came and he sat and he watched my act every day for several days, and he really pulled it to pieces. And he told me everything I was doing wrong and everything would look better if I did it. And then we started doing it that way, and every day we'd change, and it really polished the act up. And really, that's what you need to do when you're trying to get an act together, is to take criticism from somebody that's been in the business, that has a little class themselves, that knows what you're doing wrong, what you should do, and not be bullheaded about it. You know, you got to take criticism from a professional, because if they're there to help you, I mean, if they're sincere, they will help you. And so it does help a lot. And but this circus world is great for this now. They are training. They have a circus school there, like, and they have a Faye Alexander, who's one of the first men to do the triple. He was in the movie Trapeze, doubled for Tony Curtis. He is a trainer over there, and they are doing some fantastic work with the younger people over there in the aerial work, because he is well experienced, and he's a retired flyer, so he's got all the knowledge that anybody'd ever need to train people. So something like that, that's a lot more opportunity for children now than there was years ago. Because I was going to come to Florida State University, I wrote, but it was just too far away from home, but because of their circus. Because I want to be in a circus so bad. And if I'd have went to the university there, maybe I'd have stayed in school. I wouldn't have quit school after the first year.
It's funny. Do most of the children growing up in the circus, do they want to stay with the circus, or do they want to...
A lot of them do, but there's a few of them that just gets completely away from it. A lot of the performers, especially the European people who've been in the business for generations, they force their children into it, really. And the American way now is not to force anybody into anything, it seems. The children has their own way anymore. And a lot of the European acts, I think the children are getting so Americanized that they just, after a while, they just walk off from their family, you know, or get away from their family and go do something else. So it's getting away from the traditions like it was years ago. And I think even now, even the American people that's in business, a lot of business people right here in town, their children has been in family and worked in their business, they have went on to different things and worked for different companies because maybe they didn't like it. Maybe they got pressured too much when they were young to learn the business. You know, there's several reasons, I suppose.
I guess it's good that they have the college then, because in the past, I would imagine that father would pass it on to son, mother,
right,
to daughter.
Right, right.
But now, you have kids who never grew up in the circus.
Right. Well, see, Sarasota also has the high school circus there, the Sailor Circus, and that's been going on for years, and that's a good tradition. And there's a lot of circus people that's going there to school. Plus, there's gives the opportunity to some of the local people to become very good, and a lot of them have become very good circus stars just from this what they learned in high school. And some of them has went on to college. In fact, some of the people that went to college has, you know, done the triple somersault and the 3.5 and all that. And they learned, you know, practiced up there in Tallahassee. And then some of them went on into the business and worked on the circus. But like I said, the circus business, you have to be very dedicated because you give up a lot to be on the road. And some people, after they're on the road for a while, they don't care for it, even though they got the skills to be very good performers. There's reasons they get off, maybe financial reasons because they can't make it because of the expenses now.
Well, it seems like a lot of the people we've talked to so far, I mean, they didn't come from circus families, and they just see a circus when they're a little kid and they run away. Or
you've talked to many people that way, you said?
Yeah, a lot of that seems to be a common story.
Well, it is. It is. Yeah, there's a lot of old families. Well, I don't know. Even some of the Europeans I know, I think they really didn't come from a circus family. Some of them, even that I know, they have gotten into business in Europe by apprenticeship, you know, and aren't that way. I have a friend that's on the Ringling Show, and he is promoting something which I think is very interesting now. It's the National Association for the Preservation of the Circus Arts of America.
He
is promoting this, and he has become the president of the corporation. They formed a nonprofit organization in Illinois, and I think he's got a very good point there, because I think the Ballet Association in the United States is funded by the government. There's a lot of arts that are funded by the government, and they are backed by many corporations, multi-million-dollar corporations in the United States, like Shell Oil sponsors the opera sometimes, or maybe I'm not saying Shell necessarily, but maybe one of the oil companies. And if you pick up a lot of these Time and Life magazines, you'll see ads for the ballet, National Ballet, or they have all these national companies. And I was in Mexico City recently, and they have that ballet folklore thing of the, which is sponsored by the government, which is a tremendous thing in their main. In Mexico City there, and that also travels. But the circus has been neglected in the United States. Russia has the Moscow State Circus. They have several permanent buildings in Russia in different large major cities that has a permanent circus, and that's subsidized by the government, and the circus performers looked up on over there. And, I mean, to become a circus performer, you really got to stay with it, or they make you go do something else. And Bulgaria, a lot of the communist countries have their their state circuses, and Polish state circus. And I think he's got a good point here. If he just get enough people behind him, he's soliciting circus fans, anybody that wants to join right now, to join for $10. But then after he gets it going and gets able to hire an office crew and such, and then get the corporations behind him. His dream is to put a show on the road that the American public can afford to go and see, where they can pack him in every day, a very good show to keep the tradition up, but also to keep up some of the old-time circus tradition and not have to worry about the muddy lots, such as to say, like a week of rain, you're going to go broke. He wants to have the money there so that if they know they have a week of muddy lots, that they'll continue going.
Why do you think it's true? You know, circus arts are just as disciplined, if not more disciplined, than many other arts that are supported, quote unquote, fine art.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think the circus in America has been so neglected, whereas in other countries?
I don't think anybody's really taken a hold of it and realized to do this. I think that's a lot to do with it. It's like the state of Florida hasn't done too much. I mean, Ringling gave the art museum to the state of Florida and such as that for the art. And like Wisconsin took it upon themselves. They had a couple representatives in their state capital there, whatever, that was circus fans, such as to say. And I think they're the ones that probably pushed to have a state museum there, and the Ringling Corps to become available, and they got the state to fund it, to get the money together. And I imagine some of, well, I tell you, there was a few wealthy people there in Baraboo area that actually put the money up in the first place to get the show on the road, such as to say, up there. And then the state took it over and took, I mean, they proved to the state it could be done. And they put a lot of their own money in, their time and things in to get it going. And I think that now the state realizes it can pay for itself with the proper management. And Wisconsin was the home of 34 circuses, I believe, something like 34 circuses come out of Wisconsin, which you think, how could anybody winter up there all winter? But they really did. They kept their animals up there and everything. And myself, I'm from a very small town in Ohio, which is less than 1,000 people. We had a circus in my hometown back in the 1900, and it's in our history book, in our Ashbillo County history book. And I think maybe that's why I really got interested in circus, listening to my grandmother tell me stories about the circus, and the elephant used to live in our hometown. And then the daughter of the circus owner, she was like 90 years old when I was a kid, and she had like two big statues out in front of lions, and that always fascinated me, you know, to have, see these lion statues. And then my mother was named after her, in fact. Zella, which is a very unusual name. So that really attracted me, maybe to the circus. Maybe that's what got me started on it. But that town was very small there, and I think we had a circus winter there, and there's still a statue there, which is like, it's in the historical book and everything, the picture of it, and it's in a farmyard where one of the horses was buried, and they built a beautiful marble statue to it from the circus. And the statue right now is almost about 80 years old. So, I mean, you know, there's a lot of little shows years ago was all over the United States. Unbelievable, really. Ohio had a few, but Wisconsin was the mother of circuses. And that actually where the Ringling Brothers came from, Baraboo. So.
Well, why are they here now? I mean, why Florida?
Well, in the history, they like wanted to get away from the cold weather, and they moved to Bridgeport when they combined with Barman Bailey, and then they went down to Sarasota to get to the good weather. And they had a lot of money at that time, the Ringling Brothers, and they bought a lot of real estate, a lot of property, and got into other things, and that's why they got into Sarasota.
How did Gibson Town start?
Well, you know, I have been here 20 years, and there's been people that's here a lot longer than me. It could probably really tell you completely. Mm. But I came here because there was a lot of show people here. There was a few circus people here, but there has been more and more came all the time. I have brought several people here to stay with me, and they ended up buying property here that was circus performers. But as far as I know, years ago, it was a very small little town on the river, of course, and there was a trailer park over where the county park is now, and some of the carnival people came there and stayed, and then they started buying property around here, and the property was very reasonable that time. It was unzoned. They could do what they wanted to out here. They could have their animals in the backyard. They could put their tents up. They could have their trailers here and everything. So, and then they got a little club together. There was the Eddie's Hut at first, where the gas station is now, and they used to have a meeting place there. They all sit around there every night and play cards and maybe drink, or I remember they sold beer in there or not, but they would sit around, you know, and just talk, have jam session more or less, and talk. And anyways, they would. Then they decided to start the Showman's Club about 14 years ago, and they built the Showman's Club here, which is the International Independent Showman's Club. It's a little different than the Tampa Showman's Club, because they figured they let men and women both join this one. But the Tampa Club is only men only, and then they have an auxiliary for the ladies. And then another thing, this club here is circus, carnival. Anybody in outdoor show business is welcome to join. So.
And is it open on weekends?
The meetings are on Friday nights during the season, which runs from November until the last of March. And during the summer, it is closed. The Sarasota has show folks at Sarasota Club, which is open year-round, like two or three nights a week. But they are letting a few town people in down there also. But the Gibsonton Club is trying to keep strictly the people that has been on the road. And so they only operate from November until 1st of April, because everybody leaves by then pretty well on the road. So they're open 7 days a week over here. They open at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. They're open till they have like a bar room and a game room. So if you want to take somebody over for a drink, you can go over, and it's being at club prices. And then there's a game room, and then like I said, they're starting a little museum. They got a few old billboards there from 1900 and stuff, and showcases. They're trying to, this new committee's trying to get a lot of collectible things and put them in showcases, protect them. And anything is donated, they're going to keep. Anything that's loaned, they will return, you know. And they have this wall of pictures, which used to be in Eddie's hut before they tore it down, which Eddie's hut was a private person's place, like a little trailer park and like a little restaurant's what it was, a meeting place.
Now, outsiders can go into the club, say, and have a drink, but they cannot go to the meeting?
No. Outsiders can only go in with members, and members are the only ones that can buy an alcoholic drink, because after all, there's state liquor laws, you know, and that, they have to protect that. So actually, members are the only ones that can go in there without any problems, you know, to buy a drink. And members are allowed to take guests in and buy their guests a drink or whatever, and see the club set up or whatever, what they go for, just to sit and talk. Like, there's a lot of show people that aren't members of the club that comes down here in the wintertime. They have extravaganza in February, and it runs on for a week. And it's like a trade show of all the suppliers comes to it. So at that time, we get a lot of people that aren't members of the club that comes, and at that time it's open house for everybody. It has been, but I believe this year they are going to try to regulate it to members and guests only. They're going to kind of more or less check people, because they, you know, people will abuse things when they're open, free for everything. You get a lot of people that takes advantage of it. But the club meets on Friday nights, and the meeting is closed to anybody except members. But as soon as the meeting's over, members are allowed to bring guests in. And they have a dance band every Friday night, and a little get-together, you know. So it makes a nice place for people to go. And then on Sundays, they have special events. And they have Christmas parties for the children. They do a wonderful thing here. They have a Christmas basket, which they spent about $50 a piece, and they gave away 92 or 93 baskets this year to needy people that really needed food. And the members give names in, and then they have a committee that gets together, and they get all the baskets. They pack them on a certain day, like a week before Christmas, they deliver them. And then they have a Christmas party for the children, members' children, and they give them about $40 worth of Christmas gifts. And this is all money donated by the members, raised by the members, and given, the club doesn't really pay for it. Club, not all their membership money. It's, they do things to raise it.
Do you think it's a pretty close-knit community, the show folks who live around here?
it is at times. It's a little clannish at times.
Uh-huh.
It's a little clannish at times. But everybody kind of respects everybody else. And they, you know, they're united, you know, we stand, you know. So when anything, when it comes to problems, they will unite very fast. But they do have their differences, like any family does, you know, over certain items. But when it becomes a problem, say like over the zoning problem, when we found zoning is going through, the club hired an attorney, and they got some of the men here in town. It was carnival people and show people, and they discussed the problems. Discussed our problems, and luckily the Planning Commission listened to our problems, and between everybody, they ironed everything out, so we got show business zoning. Mm-hmm. So it gave the show people that was here a little bit of leeway. They could do what they had been doing, so they wouldn't have no problems with it, because the property, they had to be zoned because of the laws from Tallahassee said everything has to be zoned. And being unzoned, they had to do something. So the county, you know, made a show business zoning, which I think is the only one in the United States with such zoning.
I know in Sarasota they were saying they have all kinds of problems.
They have all kinds of problems. They zone people out. But that's kind of cooled down a little bit now. It's just like here, they made this show business zoning, and they made it protect everybody. And I realize, like, if they really insist, anybody that has show business zoning will have to put up a big fence maybe or something, you know. But it's if you get along with your neighbors, there should be no problems, you know. And it's just like anything. There's a lot of laws that's broken every day, not only in zoning, but in anything, the laws are broken. If somebody don't complain, you know, it's a different thing. But they have the laws in the books to protect the other people, you know. So at least the laws are there.
What's the story behind the Giants Fish Camp?
Well, she may be a very interesting person for you to talk to. She's still alive. No, he passed away years ago, but his wife, she's Jeannie, and she's a half lady. She has no legs.
Oh.
And their picture's hanging in the Giants camp there.
Is it?
Yeah, it shows her looking over an alligator pit. But it just shows her body. But her daughter runs the bait shop there, Judy, and they're very nice people. They're bird fanciers. That's how we know them, too. But they're very nice people, and they may be very interesting to talk to because she has been here for years. She could tell you about Gibsonton. And she lives up there. So you go up to that bait shop up there by the Giants camp and ask for Judy.
Was he
was very tall. He was on the Ringling Show and a lot of the big carnivals. Yeah, Al Tamani, his name was.
Yeah,
he's
very giant?
Tall. Oh, yes. I don't know exact height of him, but he was, his picture's there. And he died just before I came to town. Like I said, I've been here 20 years, so he died. He's been dead probably 22 or 23 years. I don't know really the exact years he's been dead. But.
And did his wife travel the...
Yes. Oh, yes. Yeah. And they've had that property up there for as long as I've known. That's been the Giants camp, like I said, for 20 years. And I came through here in 1955, and it was a Giants camp in 1955, and Eddie's Hut was there in 1955. So I did get into Eddie's Hut before they tore it down. I barely remember it, but I did come through, and I went in there with some when I was on the show.
I noticed when we were coming in, too, there's a little tattoo shop.
Yeah, that's just recently come up there this year, yes.
Uh-huh. Do show people get tattoos on
them? Well, a lot of your roughies, as you'd say, are ride boys or prop boys or stuff. They're like sailors, you know. They like tattoos. They like to have their body decorated up. And, of course, then there is tattooed people that goes in the sideshow that they make a business of it to have their entire body tattooed just to become an attraction. So, I mean, he probably does quite a good business here because he has that type of people that would go for that. Like, around Seaport, you see tattoo shops, too, like in California. Of course, there is laws to protect people now, and, you know, I guess they have to operate underneath different health standards and stuff because there is a type of infection that could be gotten from it. But it's, like I said, it's that type of people, you know, around Seaports and then with the carnival people, a lot of the working people likes to be decorated up with tattoos. So
they call them roustabouts?
Roustabouts, yeah.
They're with the circus.
Roustabouts or roughies, or they got a lot of names for them.
You find a big difference between, say, carnival people and circus people?
There is. There definitely is. I would say there's some people that's kind of versatile. They like either one, but generally the carnival people really don't like circus. Sometimes they like circus people in a way. But in a way, a lot of them don't like it because they don't like the moving. Circuses move every day, and it's very hard work. Carnivals move into a town for a week. They work very hard on the weekend. They may be up for 2 days sitting up, tearing down, and moving. But then they've got the rest of the week to recuperate. But the circus people they just go, unless they're with a building-type show or arena show that stays in the town for a week. So really, there is a complete difference. You find a few of the roustabouts, the roughies or whatever, that has been on both. But they generally don't just go back and forth. They generally finally pick their one and stay with it. Mm-hmm. They pick one or the other. And if they're circus, they're circus. They like the show, they like the music, they like the lights and stuff with the animals or whatever. And if they're ride boys, it likes putting the rides up and being around that, you know, with the mechanical stuff and being around the carnival, then that's generally what they like. That's generally what they stay at.
Mm-hmm. What is something you mentioned, like Holiday on Ice? How does Holiday on Ice and Ice Capades and those kind of shows fit into, because they're not really carnival and they're not circus?
Well, they're a traveling type show, so I guess you'd call them a traveling show. And like Ice Capades maybe, or Holiday, I'm not really sure. I've been interested in ice shows for years, too. I try to make everyone I see, go see everyone possible, and I even worked on an ice show circus combination. They tried to combine them at times, which didn't work out too well, but I worked on a big one up in Procter & Gamble was going to sponsor up in Indiana, and we showcased it in Indianapolis and Fort Wayne and South Bend and Evansville, but then the company, they dropped I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of dollars in the show. Anyway, they decided not to go on with it. It was a coupon deal. Whether you'd bring a coupon out from the box of Tide and so much money and get in to see the show. Well, like I said, we showcased it for like 5 weeks or 4 weeks up there in those towns, and it it didn't really get off the ground, maybe because of promotion, but it was a beautiful show. And it was an ice show production type thing with the girls and the boys skating and the productions and some specialty acts. Plus, they had an elephant on ice skates. Not on ice skates, I'm sorry. Jumped the gun there. I was saying that they got an elephant at roller skate. They had the elephant on the ice. They had a complete ice platform on top of the elephant's back, and the girls skated on the elephant's back. I have a picture of that at home. But unfortunately, my pictures aren't very well organized. But anyways, it was quite an attraction. Then they had the aerial acts with it. And they even had a cat act with it, lion act, you know. So some of the ice shows, I was going to say, started using specialty acts. So they drew them from the circus. So there has been some circus people that became ice show performers merely because they went over there with their specialty act. And then between shows, they got to practice skating and got to run around on skates. And then they got good at skating, so they end up going in the ice show. And some of the people have become skaters. But there again, skaters, chorus girls and chorus boys, get a minimum salary, which is the union regulates, which maybe is $175 a week or whatever it is, plus their transportation and room. And to make anything, you know, it's a nice thing. But a lot of your ice skaters are actually college students that folks do have money or something. And it's like a pastime for them when they're young and they're energetic, because ice shows are very specific on who they after you get so old, they don't want you. They want you to, they keep your weight a certain weight, and they keep everybody real trim and real neat. And if you get after a certain age, it's hard to get to skate on an ice show unless you're a real specialty act, a comedy act, or something really special. So I would say that that's why the ice show and circus, there is a few circus performers that do work on ice shows even now. And I have a friend that has a dog act on one ice show, but he has learned how to skate and he's put his act on ice skates. And I started to put my bird act on ice skates until I had my accident. But you know, it's a novelty thing, and it's just another form of entertainment. And it's very closely, it's closer to the circus than it would be the carnival, because it's a production type thing. And now that Ringling Brothers bought out Holiday on Ice units, and they own the show and they produce the shows, so it's very close now, closer than it ever has been, the circus and the ice shows.
Do show people have like a retirement fund or anything? Or